Good morning, everyone. Welcome to our Young Scholars panel. This is something that we put together this year in response to some comments from previous conferences. People wanted to see some of the newest research coming out of people or coming from researchers who are just entering the field. And we have a real variety of researchers. Not everybody here is specifically working in sound archives, but they have their research has some connection to recorded sound. And several of them also have a connection to UCLA. So our first presenter is Pamela Baird. She is an MLIS student at the UCLA School of Information Studies. And she's been working with us in the Ethnomusicology Archive this past year as part of her master's thesis project to compile a history of the Ethnomusicology Archive over the past 50 years. So it's a project that we're really excited about, and she's going to present some of her research here.
Thank you, Aaron. The Ethnomusicology Archive was founded in 1961 to support the work of the Institute of Ethnomusicology. It's celebrating its 50th anniversary this year. And I was encouraged to bring handouts to help you all remember what I'm speaking about today. You all did receive a brochure of the archive in your conference bag, so you can take that out anytime and look at that. If you've lost track of it, I've got some more, and my handout is actually a happy 50th birthday balloon to help celebrate the archive. If you want to pass this around. Or, okay, to help celebrate. I am a library school student and a history major. I've been working on institutional history of the archive. I'm pleased to share with you what I've learned about this facility. Researching the archive has brought me into the world of ethnomusicology, that is field recordings of beautiful faraway places that I've never been to and probably never will go to. I will be talking about the circumstances and the personalities that brought the Institute and the archive to life at UCLA. And it's a small group, but I'm wondering how many of you are familiar with ethnomusicology. If not, I've got a few of the many definitions that are out there about what ethnomusicology is. The SEM website has a broad definition, and two of the co-founders have something a little more definitive, the stepchild of social science and humanities, or ethnomusicology is what ethnomusicologists do. That's everybody's favorite. Here's the Ethnomusicology Archive in its present location. It moved here in 1982. If you're here for a few more days in LA, you may want to go over to the campus and look inside, but you may want to call Aaron first to make sure he's not sleeping in on Monday. And if you can't make it, please check out the website. The website is on the brochure as well, and there's some really fun stuff on the website. This report will be covering the time period highlighted, the period of the Institute, plus a little more on either side. The Institute of Ethnomusicology operated from 1960 to 1974, and before the Institute, the emphasis in the music department was on music education. By the 50s, in addition to Western classical music, courses were being offered in folk music, then world music, cultural area studies, and ethnomusicology theory. During the Institute years, more studies were added as faculty strength and student interest led. The archive was established, the publications program was started, and study and performance groups became credit courses instead of extracurricular activities. After the Institute, the program continued to grant music degrees with an ethnomusicology specialty, and the archive continued to add collections. UCLA became the first program to award undergraduate degrees in ethnomusicology in 1993. A brief history of ethnomusicology. Virtually all the resources I read concerning the beginning of ethnomusicology refer to Javanese gamelan music and oftentimes in context with the World's Fairs. The Paris Exposition of 1889 had the first gamelan display, and here at the Chicago World's Fair, this Javanese village was constructed for the performers that came there. After the fair, the Field Museum of Chicago was founded to preserve, catalog, and exhibit the myriad cultural treasures that remained following the fair, including the gamelan. The Friends of Gamelan in Chicago actually continued using the same gamelan until they finally bought a new one in 2000. This guy is Jaap Kunst. He's considered the father of ethnomusicology. He was born in 1891. He lived in Amsterdam and played the violin. Growing up, he traveled to the island of Terschelling in northern Holland during the summers, and he had an incredible gift for getting people to sing folk songs to him. He got really interested in folk music, and as an adult, he traveled to Dutch-ruled Indonesia to play music, but he was entranced by their music. He convinced the Minister of Colonies that a survey of Indonesian music was necessary. And from 1919 to 1934, he studied gamelan music and collected materials for the Dutch government as their official musicologist. After returning to Holland, he brought his knowledge and enthusiasm to the academic community, also many recordings, instruments, and photos from the Batavia Museum in what is now Jakarta. He taught at the University of Amsterdam, and he helped change the term comparative musicology to ethnomusicology in the 1950s. There was always some debate about the name, and David McAllister, the third of four co-founders of SEM, actually chose the term world music for his program at Wesleyan. Meanwhile, at UCLA, the 60s were bringing fast social change to the academic community. At the other University of California campus, Berkeley, demonstrations and sit-ins were making headlines, but Chancellor Franklin Murphy was more concerned with expanding programs to meet the needs of students at UCLA. He was chancellor from 1960 to 1968. He came from the University of Kansas, and after he left UCLA, he became CEO of Times Mirror Corporation. While at UCLA, he approved several new centers of study in addition to those that were begun in the 50s, including the Institute of Ethnomusicology. In 1960, two of the music department staff, Mantel Hood and Boris Kremenlyev, wrote a proposal to establish a research institute for ethnomusicology. The Ford Foundation, which concentrated its philanthropy on cultural programs, supplied a grant, and the institute was opened in 1960-ish. The archive, which consisted of a few cabinets of field tapes, began downstairs in the music building in a room shared with the campus carillon console. You know, the bells they play at noon? That was in the room. Mantel Hood was chosen as director of the institute. He had diverse interests in music, acting, and even drafting, and he did not commit to a career in music until he entered UCLA as a junior at 31 years old. Within 6 years, he had his BA, he had his master's, his PhD, and had become the youngest professor at UCLA. His interest in gamelan began when he just happened by chance to hear a recording at a friend's house. He decided to study with Jaap Kunst in Amsterdam. He received his doctorate in 1954, which, by the way, I happen to have his dissertation with me if you've never taken a look at it and are interested in it. Farther? I know, it seems so loud. Thank you. In 1958, Hood was able to go to Indonesia for UCLA. He purchased instruments, puppets, and art for the music program with a grant from the Rockefeller Foundation. His most notable purchase was the magnificent double gamelan you see here that was used by students in performance and study groups. He learned to play all the instruments in the gamelan, as well as some from other performance groups. The insight he felt he gained prompted his ideas of bimusicality. That is, that students should actually learn to play the music that they're studying. It helped prepare students for fieldwork by familiarizing them with the musical culture, and eventually brought international students to the campus for reciprocal education. Although Hood played the other instruments, his mentor, Jaap Kunst, didn't play the gamelan instruments. I don't think he disagreed with the concept of bimusicality. I just don't think he thought of it. Not everybody did agree with the concept. David McAllister said that it was too unscholarly and too much fun. to play all these music. Richard Garfias, who received the first master's degree in ethnomusicology at UCLA, he went on to start a program at University of Washington. He wasn't a believer so much either, but he said it got attention for funding. It was popular. Currently, there are 71 colleges and universities in the United States that have gamelans. And Mantlehood retired from UCLA in 1974 when the institute was de-established. In 1986, the Indonesian government bestowed on him the title Ki. It means venerable. It's kind of like being knighted. This is Charles Seeger. He came to UCLA in 1957. His music career was extensive. He was a composer, teacher, he wrote theories. He began the music program at UC Berkeley in 1912. He was the fourth co-founder of SEM, and his specialty was musical analysis. I looked at Seeger's papers in the Special Collections Archive at UCLA, and I found there were concert programs from like the 20s that he had written handwritten analysis notes as he was watching the concerts. After a music teachers' national conference in 1940, he wrote, "We know something of other cultures than our own. We know almost nothing of other musics than our own." This is some of the technology of ethnomusicology. The wire recorder, all I can say is the use of this technology was not widespread. The phonograph, you all know, was invented by Edison in 1877. You may not know that it was used to record a gamelan playing Yankee Doodle Dandy at the Chicago World's Fair. It was used in the field. It had the cranking generator. Until about the late 1940s. The phonograph did present some problems, though, and if there's time at the end, which I know there won't be, I've got a couple stories from a publication called Early Field Recordings, edited by Anthony Seeger and Louise Spear, that has some really funny stories about phonographs gone wild. What else have I got here? The portable tape recorder. This is what made field recordings easy and quick. It had batteries, it could be metered, and the speed was constant. Like I said, Seeger was an analyst, and in 1924, Otto Kincheldy, who was a music librarian and the first president of the American Musicological Society, said of Oriental music, "The intervals cannot be measured by our whole and half-tone scale. Thus, the mellograph. It was invented by Seeger, and the mellograph measures pitch, amplitude, and spectrum and displays them on the mellogram." I'm a history major, not a music major. I don't really know what all that means. To test the machine, Seeger analyzed 76 versions of the song Barbara Allen. Many of the students used it, as well as exemplified by an entire edition of Selected Reports of Ethnomusicology. These are all different studies done on the mellograph done by students, and I could pass this around later if you want to take a look at that. There's particularly a study of Parker's mood that is in there that's kind of interesting. This is Anne Brieglieb. She was the first archivist at the archives. She played gamelan group when she was studying for her BA with Mantlehood in ethnomusicology. She went to USC to get her library degree and came back to UCLA to work in the college library. She was a friend of Shirley Hood's, who was Mantle's wife, who was also a librarian in the performing arts section. And she talked to, they all got together to invite Anne to be the archivist at the Institute, and in an email from Anne, she told me, "With little hesitation, I accepted." Although the program was new, there are not many recordings at first. Soon more students and faculty were bringing in their field recordings, and she needed to manage them. She needed to make them accessible for research for the mellograph and to train students to play. She needed them for professors to use in classrooms and for the research community. She sought help to improve the archives. She went to SEM in Indiana and toured the Archive of Traditional Music. She went to the Library of Congress. They both told her that when she figured out what she did, they should let her know how it worked. She went to Europe. She toured the archives in Vienna, Berlin, Amsterdam, London, and Paris. What she found was most other similar archives use the Outline of World Cultures by Peter Murdoch, a geolocation system similar to the one Jacob Nadel referred to on Wednesday. I don't know if you saw that. Anne built the collection first by using the bibliography of Jaap Kuntz's book, Ethnomusicology, 3rd edition, to recreate the reference collection that Mantelhood had used in Amsterdam. She published directories of other archives, reported about the European archives in the selected report. She was involved in SEM as an archive chair. She was in IASA as editor of Phonographic Bulletin, where she met her husband, Rolf Schirmsa. And the archive, she stayed till 1984. The archive moved to its present location in 82, and Anne was able to bring all the reference materials out of the music library where they had been housed for space and bring them into the archive. She received an NEH grant to start creating an online catalog, and then she retired in 1984 after spending her entire career establishing the groundwork for a functional and valuable ethnomusicology archive. After her retirement, the archive was run briefly by Nora Yeh, who moved on to Library of Congress, and then by Louise Speer, who came from ATM. And I don't know if Louise is here today. Hi, I haven't met you yet. And as far as I know, you got an NEH grant to do online cataloging as well before coming over?
Yes.
Yeah, I got it right. Currently, Aaron Biddle is our archivist, and our director is Anthony Seeger, who looks vaguely like his grandfather, who I showed you a few minutes ago. Real quick, collections that are at the archive are Colin McPhee's Balinese recordings, photos, and notes, Jaap Kunst reference collection, Mantelhood's Indonesian recordings, Arnold Bakke's Indian collection, and the restudy by Nazir Jerazboy, Klaus Waxman, who recorded in Uganda, Willard Rhodes, who recorded Native American music, and this cool cat is D.K. Wilgus, recording Sun House at the UCLA Folk Festival in 1965. A Grammy Foundation grant actually made it so the archive could digitize some of these recordings, so if you go to the website, you can hear them. We've got a few instruments still at UCLA. Doesn't the gamelan look better in color? And the Thai ensemble, and the drums from Ghana. The drums actually came when Mantelhood went to Ghana and filmed Autumn Pond, the talking drums of Ghana. They showed them making these drums, cutting the tree down, carving them, skinning them, and then they brought them back to UCLA. All the instruments are kept in playable condition, even though they're not part of the archive collection. They're actually university possessions, but they're always being played. The UCLA Ethnomusicology Archive was born in the 60s when the cultural climate was right in LA and the US and in the world. The personalities that brought it forth were perfectly suited for the situation. Mantelhood introduced bimusicality, Charles Seeger invented the mellograph for analysis, and Anne Brieglieb helped move forward sound archiving practices. Happy birthday, Ethnomusicology Archive.
Okay. Oh, all right. Thank you very much, Pam. We have a couple of minutes for questions. Yes.
Program. Disposed of?
Without developing that base, you have all of these things here.
I'm not quite sure your question. Yeah, we can play wire recordings. I'll let Aaron.
We do have a collection of wire recordings and at least one wire recorder player, although I'm not sure that it's functional and we've never tried to transfer the wires. They're a very relatively small part of our collection. And we don't really have a cylinder collection since the collection was really built from the 1960s when the archive was founded. Most of our field recordings are on reel-to-reel tape and forward, more modern formats. But, you know, if you're trying to build an archive as part of a program at New Mexico, in some respects, not having all of those old recordings is less of a hindrance, because one of the issues that we run into with those older collections is not having any of the rights. Nobody went out and secured rights or permissions for publication or streaming online, because of course there was no such thing at that point. This just wasn't thought of in those years, and often we have collections we have no contact with heirs, and so it limits what we can do with them. If you're building a collection from current materials, you can build that into the fieldwork and collection development process, and you can know right away that you have the right to stream these online or only access them in-house or whatever you choose to do with them. Any other questions? All right. Let's move on. Thank you once again, Pam. Just